Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. Okay. The matter we've got on today is docket number 67639, Little versus District Court. Are we ready to proceed? Okay, Mr. Becker, if you'll come up. And did you want to reserve time?
Yes, I'm not sure how much, probably half the time I would reserve. I've notified one of your clerks. I would like to do that. May it please the court, my name is Joseph Becker. I'm appearing on behalf of Michael Little, the plaintiff. I'd like to begin with a quote from one of my cases that I cited below. It's an illusion, one that seems to have the persistence of original sin, that prosperity can be attained by taking money from taxpayers and handing it to favored businesses. To catch everyone up on current events, briefly, the POC tried to internalize costs on SolarCity. SolarCity now plans to ditch Nevada, according to Fortune magazine. But this is exactly the kind of boondoggle that Article 8, Section 9 was inserted into the Nevada Constitution to prevent. The major check and balancing role played by the court, we're told, by Federalist 51 is to preserve individual rights and freedoms that can be threatened by a tyranny of the majority when legislatures or electors pass laws that harm a few who can't politically defend themselves. Here, however, we're asking the court to prevent tyranny by the power elite. Why?
Can you start with the basic issue of standing, why your party should even be before us?
I can certainly get to that. The party should be before us because taxpayer standing is the only thing that allows, as many, many jurisdictions in the country have decided, is the only thing that allows the Constitution of the state of Nevada and other states to be enforced. Absent having taxpayer standing, provisions of the Constitution become unenforceable.
Also, but in some cases, if we have, from your standpoint, taxpayers coming up and wanting this check and balance on every issue, unlimited, do we have a government that can go forward, if I look at it as broadly as you wish to look at it?
Well, I don't know that it's all that broadly when compared to what other states are doing. 43 states have some form of taxpayer standing. Their courts don't seem to be completely clogged up with these cases.
Why shouldn't Nevada be allowed to, in essence, parse off and semi-follow the federal standing situation?
Well, for exactly the reason that I said. Let me quote a New York court. Maybe that would be helpful. This case is Borzewski v. Bridges. It's a 1975 New York appellate court. We are satisfied that the time has now come when judicially formulated restriction on standing should be modified to bring our state's practice with respect to review of state legislative action into conformity not only with the practice in the majority of other states, but also with the procedural standing of taxpayers to challenge local actions. We are now prepared to recognize standing where, as in the present case, the failure to accord such standing would be in effect to erect an impenetrable barrier to any judicial scrutiny of legislative action.
But now, we are not New York.
No,
last time I checked.
I realize.
So are we allowed to adopt our own standing basis?
Yes, certainly you are. I think that's what this interlocutory appeal is all about.
And in some points, the order that was issued indicates on one of the issues as to standing, as to dealing with a competitor, they left that for the district court to develop at the time of trial. So why should this matter even be before us?
Well, guess what? The competitor's packing up with the $400,000 that they were given.
Well, that counsel, that's a whole side argument that might have changed based upon a ruling yesterday holding in lieu of reconsidering what the PUC did, which is not really germane to your case today. So if you can argue why your party should, why those issues should be considered. Because again, the court left you a window or a door. Why isn't that suitable or acceptable? And the first question, which you really didn't answer, was the comparison between, say, why is the approach Nevada has adopted on standing too restrictive as far as you're concerned?
First of all, I don't know that Nevada has adopted any taxpayer's dying jurisprudence. That's, I think, part of the reason we're here, is it's a case of first impression, apparently, which is a little surprising, but, you know, case law in Nevada seems to be sparse as compared to other jurisdictions. If you don't like the New York case, I mean, there's an Arizona case which is much closer, and I cited that in the case.
It's not whether I like them or dislike them. I'm just asking you to compare and contrast the two different styles.
Right. I mean, I think the problem that persists, and many states have recognized, as I quoted New York as well as Arizona, every state in the Ninth Circuit, every state that borders Nevada has adopted some form of taxpayer standing. Certainly Nevada's free to do it, but absent doing it, it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to enforce constitutional constraints on the government.
Mr. Becker, yes, I'd like to pose a question, a more threshold question, and that is whether this court should entertain this writ now. As you know, the district court has provided to your client an opportunity to pursue an as-applied argument. If you were successful, for example, in that litigation, the facial dispute or the facial challenge you make today would appear to be mooted. So the argument that has been made by respondents is that we shouldn't entertain this writ today. Why should the court entertain the writ? As you probably are aware, there's been a lot of dialogue about the extent to which this court should entertain writs of mandamus on issues of first impression, as you characterize it. Why should we entertain this writ when there's still a lot of litigation to take place in the district court, regardless of this issue? Could you comment on that?
Sure, I can comment on that. I mean, first of all, the thing you mentioned, yourself and I mentioned earlier, that it's a case of first impression, it's going to be very, very difficult for the plaintiff to proceed on the as-applied challenge. The other problem is that, you know, there are these contracts are being done by Governor's Office of Economic Development to give lots of money away, and to try and do these serially and for other plaintiffs to come forward.
I suppose as part of your argument here, there's really nothing to be developed factually in the district court with respect to your facial challenge.
That's correct.
The facts are what the facts are. And so what may take place in an as-applied challenge really doesn't matter or impact the litigation?
That's correct. We think this is, I mean, we thought this is a very straightforward case. We think there's, of course, the legislature wants to itself to define the words in the Constitution like gift, which we think is the court's province, to say that, you know, if the legislature decides something isn't a gift, it's not a gift. But, I mean, otherwise, we think it's a very straightforward question of law case, you know, whether the state can use a political subdivision as a way to channel money to a private corporation in contravention of the Constitution, and whether what they're doing is a gift when they get no direct benefit from what they're doing.
And another question, if I might, on the merits of the standing question. There appears to be from your briefs and from the Fordham Review, Law Review article, some substantial number of states that recognize taxpayer standing for these types of cases. But there appears to be a breakdown or a difference. Some states would permit greater opportunity for taxpayers to pursue a suit. It seems to me that many of the states that recognize taxpayer standing limit it to issues of public importance or major public policy.
Right.
How do you address that distinction? And if the court were to agree that public importance provides a basis, how would you define that?
I think the court can decide that. We do think it's a matter of it's a constitutional question. It's a matter of public importance. Remember, the defendants insisted, at least the legislature defendant insisted for years that the Constitution needed to be amended to do this. We had three general election votes, 92, 96, 2000, in which case every time the electors voted down by a substantial margin not to amend the Constitution. And now suddenly we've got this circumvention scheme to go around the voters and go around the language of the Constitution itself.
You mentioned that in your brief.
I think that's a significant public interest issue.
You mentioned that in your brief. Where in the appendix do you address the prior election outcomes?
I can
could
find
you
it.
Give those sites to the clerk, please,
sure.
After you're done.
Absolutely, I can do that. It is in the appendix, and I can get you the page.
You know, you've chewed into your time. I'm going to go ahead and give you two additional minutes if you want to reserve that time. And I'll extend another 2 minutes to Mr. Powers as well.
I will stop here and reserve the balance of my time, plus I appreciate the 2 minutes, and yield to the state.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for the record. Kevin Powers, Chief Litigation Counsel, Legislative Counsel Bureau, Legal Division, representing the legislature of the state of Nevada. I will divide my argument time today with Ms. Christine Gersey-Nitas with the Deputy Attorney General, and she is representing the Governor's Office of Economic Development, or GOED, and its Executive Director in this matter. At this interlocutory...
Can I just ask a quick question about standing? Is this a question of first impression as far as taxpayer standing in the state of Nevada?
It's an issue of first impression as to whether this court fully embraces the federal standard for taxpayer standing. In Stockmeyer, this court made clear that in constitutional cases, this court follows federal standing principles. This court has never said whether it would follow those federal standing principles all the way to the taxpayer standing cases of Daimler Chrysler and Arizona Christian Schools. So that's the question. This court in the past has embraced federal standing principles, and now we are asking that the court go forward and acknowledge that those federal standing principles include the taxpayer standing rules of the U.S. Supreme Court under Daimler Chrysler and the Arizona.
So LCB would agree 100% with Justice Russell as far as no standing in this case, as far
no
as this issue.
No taxpayer standing for a facial constitutional challenge. And that's the key.
Let me stop you right there. When I looked at this case, you cite Blanding, for example, which is an older Nevada case. It's in volume 52, and you quote the language that says, a taxpayer cannot maintain such a suit where he has not sustained or is not threatened with any injury peculiar to himself as distinguished from the public generally. That's normally taxpayer standing concepts. But the opinion goes on to talk about, and where it, the act of the government, is prejudicial to the rights of taxpayers as such, as involving the levy of tax, creation of a municipal debt, or appropriation or expenditure of public funds, or in any way intending to increase the burden of taxation, the great weight of authority is that if such action be illegal or unauthorized, taxpayers may sue to restrain it. It's a different species of quote-unquote taxpayer standing where the allegation, as here, is the Constitution says thou, the government, shalt not make gifts of public funds to private people. They're trying to say this program violates that prohibition. In that respect, the taxpayer does have an interest that's greater than the conventional taxpayer standing type of analysis, which would be, say, to complain about a street being built that they didn't like the way it looked or something like that. This is a direct claim that money that's gone into the state's coffers has been given to private people in violation of that constitutional provision. Why doesn't the Blanding, and I know it's dictum because Blanding did involve some sort of street that nobody liked, why doesn't that apply and really take us out of this? How could they challenge this if not by these means, I guess is my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. And my answer is two parts. First, the quote from Blanding was from a treatise on municipal law recognizing municipal taxpayer standing. The U.S. Supreme Court has recognized municipal taxpayer standing. Most state courts have. So municipal taxpayer standing is a well-accepted doctrine, and the reason for it is that it's considered that the municipal taxpayer is closer to the municipal governing body, and they're directly affected when that municipal governing body expends funds in violations of the local charter or governing statute.
Well, why wouldn't that same model apply here, where the state is channeling funds through the county or local government to spend them on private activities?
Well, and that's the argument that was made both in the U.S. Supreme Court in the Frothingham case and in other jurisdictions, that the municipal taxpayer doctrine should be extended to both federal taxpayers and state taxpayers.
Let's just talk about state.
Yes, and the U.S. Supreme Court for federal taxpayers is that the connection between the taxpayer and the federal budget is too remote, too indefinite, too minimal. And we believe that's the same as for the state. If you don't have that direct connection, all taxpayers are affected by the large state budget the same.
Well, then let me go to my second question. How does one challenge what they contend to be an unlawful channeling of money by the state to the county to pay it to private sector?
And that's the crux of all the state taxpayer standing cases. What those other states of court have found is that if, because of ordinary standing principles, there's an impenetrable barrier that prevents any plaintiff from finding standing under ordinary principles, then the state taxpayer is the taxpayer of last resort, the plaintiff of last resort. That's not the case here.
Okay, why not?
Because competitor standing under ordinary standing principles would provide individual plaintiffs the opportunity to challenge the constitutional distribution of money under the cadastral accounts, and therefore there's not an impenetrable barrier under ordinary standing principles. If a plaintiff, in this case even this plaintiff, proves competitor standing, they can then challenge the constitutionality of the catalyst count statutes. The state's fully prepared to go forward in the district court and argue the competitor standing issue and the merits.
But you don't agree that they have competitor standing either. Your point is that should be developed in the district court.
That is correct. Competitor standing is a factual issue. It's whether that he
is. But you contest it. You deny that it exists.
Here. Correct. We do deny it exists. But this plaintiff is not the only plaintiff who could allege competitor standing. There are 17 private companies that have received cadastral account grants from local governments. There are competitors for all of those companies. There are direct competitors for all of those companies. If one of those direct competitors wants to challenge the cadastral account distribution, they can claim competitor standing, and then that would be before the court.
But, counsel, why should we limit a taxpayer's ability to challenge, say, hypothetically, a direct loan made by the state to a company for which there are no competitors in the state? It seems to me that there is no way to contest what the government would do in a direct violation of the Constitution.
Fortunately, that's not the case before the court. There's a plaintiff who, this plaintiff
but
here,
if this court entertains this writ, it sets some precedent with respect to this subject matter.
Well,
so I think we should be looking forward into these potential hypotheticals.
But that gets back to the point that I don't think the court should entertain the writ because I don't think the record's been developed sufficiently.
Well, what is going to be developed in the district court on the facial challenge? What facts is the district court going to be asked to assess on the facial challenge in this case? I'm not sure I see any.
Well, I don't think a facial challenge is appropriate under the gift clause under these circumstances. In Lawrence versus Clark County, this court established a two-part test for the gift clause challenge. The state has to establish that there was a legitimate public purpose behind the distribution of public funds, and the state also has to establish that there was a valuable benefit and fair consideration received in return for the distribution of public funds. Well, that requires, in this case, for an evaluation of each of these catalyst count grants, why it was given, what reasons were given, and what the fair consideration was received in return. We need a record in the district court factually developing that in order to determine whether this was constitutional.
But would you get that under the as-applied challenge?
That's where it needs to be done as-applied challenge.
Wait a minute. I thought that Lawrence and the test in Lawrence was to develop whether a gift had occurred, which would be germane to the facial challenge. Are you suggesting that the facial challenge, in order to test it, you have to first determine whether this transaction constitutes a gift?
Well, in order to determine whether it violates the gift clause, you have to review those two elements that the court discussed in Lawrence. But also, the court also said you have to determine whether the legislature or the executive agency considered all facts, figures, and necessary information before making the decision, and there's a level of deference given to the legislative decision or the executive branch decision. A lot of that is going to be a factual inquiry based on each of these separate transactions.
But the whole point is that if under Lawrence the determination of the gift has to be developed in the district court, that can't be done because the district court has determined that they don't have a facial challenge standing. So shouldn't we answer the standing question so that the next question about whether there is a gift under Lawrence can be answered by the district court?
What we're saying is that could only be done in the context of the as-applied challenge because each of these transactions, each of these grants is different. The plaintiff's contention on the facial challenge is that no distribution of money to any private company is ever constitutional. That's just not true. That's not what the gift clause does. It doesn't prohibit all distributions of state money to private companies. It only prohibits distributions of state money to private companies if the distribution doesn't serve a public purpose and there's no fair consideration or valuable benefit given in return. Therefore, it's not enough in a facial challenge to simply prove a distribution of state money. You have to prove those additional factors. And in this case, to prove those additional factors, you have to review each grant to each of the separate entities.
Mr. Powers, isn't the petitioner in this case being deprived of the opportunity to test those the factual basis of the gift because standing has been ruled against them?
No, because if this plaintiff proves competitor standing, then he can challenge the grant from Clark County to Solar City.
Well, you've rolled over to competitor standing now. There does seem to be an awful lot of states that have recognized taxpayer standing in the United States, and it's not predicated on competitor standing.
And they, we agree they recognize taxpayer standing, but that's in those situations where there's no other basis for standing. Where
one such basis is an issue of public importance. And several of the states identified in the authority cited by the petitioner referenced that. Why isn't distribution of funds by the state to a company, maybe one in which there are no competitors, and potentially violative of the gift clause, an issue of public importance?
It could be an issue of public importance, but even in those public important cases, the courts have found it's a two-part test. First, you have to find public importance, and then you have to find that under the ordinary standing rules, no one would be able to get over the impenetrable barrier of ordinary standing. That's when state taxpayer kicks in, when there's no other standing alternative under ordinary standing rules. Competitive standing is an ordinary standing rule. If this plaintiff proves competitor standing, in this case, they can challenge the constitutionality of the catalyst account statutes, and then on appeal, this court would have the opportunity.
One thing it appears you all agree on is the ability to establish competitor standing is not available. Even petitioner seems to think that's a doubtful claim in the district court.
That may be true for this petitioner, but doesn't mean there aren't other petitioners. And that's what all of those state taxpayer standing cases focus on. Are there other potential plaintiffs under ordinary standing rules who could make the challenge?
Well, the standing doctrine, though, is prudential in our court. I mean, it doesn't carry the federal Article III case or controversy mooring. So why would we not treat this under the municipal taxpayers can challenge municipal expenditures type of model here? Why would we not do that? Tell me that.
My answer is two-part. Again, the first part is I don't believe Nevada's standing doctrine is purely prudential. I mean, under Article 6, Section 1 of the Nevada Constitution, it says that the Nevada's court system has judicial power. In Galloway versus Truesdale, this court said judicial power means the power to determine actual cases and controversies. I believe the case or controversy requirement is part of the Nevada Constitution.
And you think that informs our standing doctrine?
I think it does. And okay. I think that's why in the past this court has looked to federal case law, because the federal case law is based on that concept that judicial power can only happen in the context of actual cases and controversies that are subject to justiciable resolution. And that's why I believe from a constitutional standpoint that is part of the case law and the matter should adopt and why you should follow the federal precedent with regard to taxpayer standing. And again, if this were a situation which is not before us where there was an impenetrable barrier and there was no chance of standing, then maybe the court would have to determine whether there should be a specific narrow exception to taxpayer standing doctrine. Even the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized a narrow exception to the federal bar to taxpayer standing, and that's in the Establishment Clause cases. In Flass versus Cohen, the U.S. Supreme Court said, because of the unique nature of the Establishment Clause that protects everyone's individual liberty of conscience, there's a narrow exception that allows a federal taxpayer to go against a federal congressional action that distributes federal funds for a religious purpose. There, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized a narrow exception for federal taxpayer standing.
Do you have any cases that, and I didn't see any in your brief, that deny standing, and I'm not clear that this truly is taxpayer standing, but let's call it that, but deny that as a challenge to an allegedly unconstitutional gift of public funds. Are there any cases where a court like ours has said, no, we are not going to allow this to proceed in this fashion? We're going to require competitor standing.
We did not cite any cases in our brief, and I can't, off the top of my head, know whether that's the situation. There's an innumerable amount of standing cases.
No, there's millions of them. But in the gift prohibition context, I didn't see that you cited any.
We did not, and most of the gift cases that we cited in the lower court dealing with the substantive merit of this, those challenges involve whether it be competitors or a municipal taxpayer in the context of municipal taxpayer standing. But we don't have a case that referred to that denied standing in the gift clause context.
On that point, the structure of the Catalyst Fund channels these funds through local government. Why doesn't that provide a basis for the municipal standing rule to apply? It does appear, at least the way it's configured, that the local government is the one who's making the request. Yeah, they're the ones that's approving the money. Even in this case, I guess the money went to Solar City through Clark County. Is that right?
That is correct.
So why wouldn't municipal standing apply?
Well, in this case, it wouldn't apply because, one, the plaintiff didn't allege it in his complaint, mm-hmm. and, two, the plaintiff didn't raise it on summary judgment, so he waived that issue. He made his standing based on state taxpayer standing and competitor standing. Mm-hmm. So at this late juncture in the case, he's waived any claim of municipal taxpayer standing. If the court wants to pursue that further, we had asked that you allow us to brief that issue further mm-hmm. because at this stage, that was never raised in the court below.
But factually, there's no dispute, I guess, the way the Catalyst Fund operates. It operates, as I understood from your brief, the way I've articulated it.
How the Catalyst Fund operates is that a business goes to a local government and asks the local government to make an application to GOED for the Catalyst account money. GOED then reviews the local government's application. If GOED approves the local government application, GOED gives the money to the local government, who then distributes the money to the business.
Okay. Thanks.
And that ends our time. I don't know if the court wants to provide Ms. Gersey-Nias with any additional time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Becker?
A couple comments I want to make as a result of the questions that were asked. The first one is the appendix pages are 0044. Through 0054 with respect to the vote tallies and the measures as were presented to the Nevada electors. So that's all there. I would say that Stockmeyer's dicta as well. The defendants rely heavily on Stockmeyer for saying that it's a federal case. But this is a case about a non-taxpayer who happens to be in the penal system who wanted access to a public meeting, a parole meeting, and he had standing under the statute itself. So whatever is said about federal taxpayer standing applying is dicta in that case as well. As far as the municipality versus the state and whether we waive that, I think it's a good point that the court raises. But if we take a look at Arizona Supreme Court, I cited an Ethington v. Wright case. The language from that says, it is now almost the universal rule that taxpayers of a municipality may enjoin the illegal expenditures of municipal funds. The right to maintain such suits is based upon the taxpayers' equitable ownership of such funds and their liability to replenish the public treasury for the deficiency which would be caused by the misappropriation. But they went on to say, for these and other reasons, the courts of this country, with very few exceptions, have held that the same principles which permit a taxpayer to enjoin the waste or illegal expenditure of municipal funds permit the same kind of proceedings by state taxpayers concerning state funds. Now, in Lawrence v. Clark County, this court said that Nevada should follow Arizona gift clause jurisprudence. But to do so requires also, as in Arizona, that a taxpayer has the standing to do so. I think there's a problem with not having federal taxpayer standing because there's no, according to the district court, there's no facial challenge then. If you don't have taxpayer standing, you can't do a facial challenge. If you can't do a facial challenge, the court's going to wind up hearing this long series of as-applied challenges, which, you know, frankly, are very, very difficult. If they say we don't have competitor standing, we have an expert economist who comes at great expense, unlike GOED, who apparently has no economist, according to the deposition testimony. We have an expert economist that says, yeah, we have competitor standing. But competition, as the court has tended to define it, is very narrow, current, and direct. But that's not the nature of competition. Competition is the threat to enter the market. It's a contestable market theory. It makes it very, very difficult for us to prove that we are a competitor. And now, of course, the closest competitor is apparently disappearing, which makes, of course, we now have to start over. But this, of course, is the reason I would say that taxpayer standing is vital, especially now. Otherwise, you're going to wind up with this long series of cases which are going to burden the court. So I think these are the main points that I wanted to make. I have a couple minutes left. Let me review my notes. Are there any questions from the court before I proceed here? I think that's what I have, unless there are more questions.
Do you have any feeling if the state goes after SolarCity to get the money back, what that does to your case, or this whole issue?
Well, my reading of the contract, of course, there are other, he identified some other number of contracts which are going forward, which we believe violate the gift clause prohibition as well. I think the contract is if they bring in so many people for a certain amount of time, they get paid the money. I think they did bring in a certain amount of people for a certain number of time. But, you know, I reiterate that this is exactly the kind of illegitimate economic scheme that the Constitution was designed to prevent.
Don't a lot of the cases on taxpayer standing look at prospective injunctive relief one way and retrospective disgorgement type relief as an entirely different kettle of fish? And so does this case now, if the money's gone and the people are gone, what's left of it as a justiciable case?
Well, with respect to SolarCity, that might be true. I know that this...
No, we're arguing outside the record because I don't know what you're waving at us, but I'll accept your word for it. We're arguing outside the record because what you brought to court today is not part of what we have.
Right.
But is there something alive and well and remaining to be litigated here if the money's gone?
I guess they haven't left the state. There is still a contract which would have them paid $400,000 this summer and another $400,000 next side.
Okay, and that's in the record that there's more payments to be made.
That is the record, the contract. It's in the appendix. But there are also all these other contracts without a facial challenge. You know, some other competitor is going to, assuming again that there even is another competitor who's willing to come forward and do this. You know, the problem persists, the unconstitutionality persists, and again, you know, I guess I'd remind the court one more time, PA 0044, PA 0054, the voters overwhelmingly rejected this, and when they were told that it took a constitutional amendment by defendants in order to make this thing happen.
Any other questions?
I'll return the balance of my 31 seconds. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much for the briefing and the arguments today. This matter will stand submitted.